You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to the inaugural episode of the PeltonCast Chef Series. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton,
and I'm Tristan Carcino,
and we are thrilled to welcome Eater Seattle's 2018 Chef of the Year, Eric Rivera from Otto, for the kickoff of this new series. Thanks for joining us, Eric.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It sounds like super formal with that title to begin with. I'm definitely not that cool, man.
Well, I mean, you mentioned in your DM to us, so this got started after we talked about the Lechoncito ramen that you put on the menu a couple weeks ago as part of the 206 takeout series. And you were like, I'm surprised when anyone likes the things that I come up with. Is that really how you approach it at this point?
Yeah. I always have this thing of I make something, I taste it like 25 times, whatever. And then I send it out into the world and I'm like, they're going to fucking hate it. And that's like every it's literally every single time. And I don't know sometimes. I mean, sometimes, I'll take a few steps back. In restaurant, when I have people in the dining room, you can tell if they like it or not. Yeah. This is flying blind now because, you know, pandemic life. So you have no way of knowing. And it could be 20 minutes before they get home. You know, if they come to pick it up at the restaurant or you're sending it to them, then they have to reheat it. They could fuck it up. You know, so there's all these like variables now. So I kind of just put in my head, I'm like, they're going to hate it. And that's how I treat this whole thing now. I'm like, they're going to fucking hate it. So, yeah.
That's a safe way to approach things. How do you feel like, you know, with this takeout culture, obviously that has to exist. Mm-hmm. Are there ways that you're able to counterbalance that by maybe making dishes that travel a little bit better?
Yep. There's different stages and levels of it that I've made. There's stuff that is, you know, the grand champion equipment that has come back to be part of everybody's life, the microwave. Back at it, microwave. You know, all of a sudden people were talking shit about it for years, going like, don't microwave things, you're gonna get whatever. And now it's like, hey, buddy. So designing things that work with that, designing things that work with someone who wants to kind of level their dinner up a little bit, walking them through that process, having instructions, then all the way down to what the aesthetic is going to be. So the aesthetic was really big inside of the restaurant, but now it's like garnishes don't hold up. You know, little fancy, beautiful touches of the things that I do that make it seem cool and I can charge a lot of money for, that stuff doesn't exist. So it's really like having to like punch the ego down and basically strip it and go, well, what do I want to do? Is it all this fancy stuff or do I just want to feed people because they need it? So there's a lot of different variables to all of that.
All right, to go back to something you said, how are you getting feedback now? Is it social media? Is that the primary way? Or are there other vehicles that you find out what's working and what's not?
There's a lot of different ways. You know, social media, I'm pretty strong on that game. So people can tell me or they DM me or whatever. And they're like, hey, this is cool. Or that sucked. Or, you know, the one that I don't pay attention to, like Yelp. I don't care what anybody says on there. They can spend their whole lifetime telling me I'm a terrible person. And I'd just be like, fuck you. You're on Yelp. You don't know what you're talking about. But there's other stuff, you know, like people will 24 hours a day. I mean, we're shipping some things nationwide in a different time zone. So there's, you know, times where I'm waking up, you know, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, it's 7 o'clock on the East Coast. And somebody's like, hey, I just got this thing. It's cool. It's great. Or, you know, something broke in the box and what are we going to do? So there's a lot of different ways. We don't have a phone here. So that kind of frustrates people, but I'm like, it's 2021. Like, I'm not going to send you a carrier pigeon with this takeout shit, you know, like let's modernize ourselves a little bit. So it's the feedback comes in different ways. I think a lot of times people, when the pandemic first started, there was a different expectation. So people were actually having to cook a little bit more themselves than just picking something up from the restaurant. They had to reheat things. They had to do extra steps. And there were people that weren't cool with that. There was one guy that emailed me and was like, this does not feel like fine dining. And I'm like, well, you're at your own home, so that's on you. if your house doesn't feel like fine dining, I don't know what to tell you, but the food is, you know. So there's a lot of different things that, you know, in a year of doing this now, that I've kind of figured out and optimized, and then still communicate with the guests and go like, you're still going to have to warm this up. You're going to receive it cold, and then you're going to go home, and here we are. So it's just working through all that.
How are you typically building those menus? Because I think, you know, one of the things that we've been really impressed by over this last year is just how inventive the menus have been and how much they've changed throughout the year.
Yeah, that's basically on supply and demand. That's really what it comes down to. I'm on the back end all the time, looking at our kind of like data analytics, what is a meme I can jump on to sell, to, you know, kind of like go like, here's something stupid that people are laughing about. Can I make a food thing around that and make it funny for everybody? But also taste good. So there's a bit of opportunist strike, you know, into that, which is cool, which I like. That's
Bernie
fun for
Sanders
me.
With his mittens coming.
Exactly. And, you know, put a Hot Pocket in there. It'll keep you warm. But it's little things like that, that I like, that's always kept me kind of being creative. And, you know, so we've done almost 300 different programs in the last year, which is a lot. Some of the stuff works really well. Some of it doesn't. Some of the people like it a lot, but it just doesn't move on past that. So they get tired of it. And you know, the gift and the curse of me pitching this space to begin with was we're always going to have something different. So we have guests that are like, man, I really like that. And then I don't see them buy it, but they still tell me how much they like it. So then I'm like, I need to do something different. You know, I can't wait for them to come back or buy again. I have to keep things new. So that's always the thing for me, is trying to keep things new, trying to keep things exciting. Whether it's being super hyper seasonal with something and sounding like that restaurant, or going, hey, here's some tater tots with spam and cheese on it. That sounds dope, right? You know, you're at home, you're going to have a few drinks. You're probably going to do some other stuff. But if you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, you have tater tots and spam waiting for you in the refrigerator, you know? So it's kind of like trying to figure out how to live with them. You know, essentially like I'm like their private chef.
Yeah. Do you have any personal favorites that you've made from throughout the year?
Man, no. No. I have things that I think that are really good, but I don't have anything that I make where I'm like completely happy with it. The Sistone, like the spice mixes and stuff, I think that's like, that's pretty solid, but I don't have anything where I'm like, oh, this is my one dish or my 10 dishes or my 20, because I'm always like fussing with it anyway. And I take pictures on my side that a lot of like you guys don't see that, but I see it because then I look at it again and I was like, I hate it. Change it. Or it seems too boring, or what am I doing? Who am I trying to feed with this? Like, is it me? Is it them? Is it something of a different diner? Like somebody's looking for something. Do I see somebody complaining about another restaurant? And then I can go in on the backside and be like, I got you. It's a really weird place, man, but it works for me.
You mentioned all the different varieties that you go through before, you know, attempts you go through before something makes it on the menu. How long mm-hmm. is that process for one item?
It could sometimes be right out the gate where it works. And I'm like, yeah. But a lot of times it's a couple days. Cause I like to try it, taste it, plate it, look at it again, taste it again, see how it's going to reheat, get cold again. See if there's a seasoning thing I'm missing, seeing if I was off that day, meaning like mentally when I tasted it. And I come back to it and I'm like, why did I think this was okay? Because I think the difference is like, once you start charging people for food, the pressure kind of starts. It's very different than being in your house and like friends and family. When I was younger in my career, everything I made was amazing. And oh, this is just incredible. And I realized that was like them being positive and trying to like help me. But I had to adopt a filter of my own being like, this isn't good enough. There's going to be somebody that hates it. Who's that hater? You know, and how many of them are there? And however many there are, like, I don't know if I need to make it for them, but at least get to a point where I can find enough people that like it and keeps things going. So
That's really interesting, actually. I had not considered that of basically like the difference, the extra step from being like good chef at home where you're cooking for yeah. your family and friends to selling food to other people.
Yeah. And I started this very differently. You know, my professional career, I started off as a food blogger and I'd come from a different, you know, business background. And then I got to a point where I had a friend of mine, he was like, you need to figure this out. And if you want to keep doing this as a little hobby or if you want to take it seriously. And so then, you know, I applied at a bunch of restaurants around the city and nobody would take me seriously. So then I went to culinary school and then started working in restaurants and started working in like really high end, crazy restaurants and started, you know, traveling around a little bit and it really fueled it. I figured that I can kind of make it work for myself. But it's been a struggle, man. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of time to develop the skill, the creativity. That's one thing, but then managing it. And then the other thing is then owning it and having a restaurant and, you know, paying bills, and they can get pretty massive. So it's very crazy stages, for really not much return, but when people say they like it, that's cool. That's the part I like. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough industry in the best of times, and these are far from the best of times. I mean, it has been now, you know, over 10 months that we've been in this period of staying home and your restaurant hasn't been open. I mean, is there a sense of loss in terms of not having people be able to come and gather at the restaurant and have that sort of shared communal experience?
Yeah, you know, I've spent a lot. I'm not a very social person. I'm very Northwest. and I'm like a curmudgeon. And so it took me about 7 years to really get comfortable working in front of people without having a barrier, meaning like going to guests, mm-hmm. talking to them, understanding who they are, realizing regulars, learning who they are, learning what they like, being able to make something for them that's just for them. And then I kind of amplified that over time with, you know, tasting menus and chef's counters and stuff like that. So I had to figure out a way to do all that stuff. And I can't do any of that right now. And I feel like that's what I got really good at. I got very, very good at having somebody, you know, 8 people in front of me at a chef's counter, shooting the shit with them and compartmentalizing each couple or group or whoever was there and then making it unified really quickly. Or leaving the 2 on the end of loan who are like, you know, making out or whatever. but it's like, you can kind of like play it in stages. And I got really good at that. And especially within the dining room and having a good flow and have a good energy in the space with music and all this kind of stuff. Like none of that exists anymore. So even with that, our programming was very different. Meaning for food, we were I was predominantly serving seafood here. 80% of our menu, 85% of our menu was seafood. Like, stellar stuff. And that stuff doesn't travel well because what somebody does with seafood themselves is very different than what I do. And I got to be really highly skilled at it where I'm like, nope, that little extra 3 seconds, it's fucked. You know, it's broken, it's over, it's not what it needs to be. Because when you charge somebody a couple $100 for a tasting menu, the expectation is set. So it's having to reimagine everything, what we serve, the food we do, how it is. You know, I started doing a pasta program because I bought an extruder. Talk to me 2.5 years ago and I'd tell you how pasta was a scam. You know, and I was like, I don't understand. There's like restaurants around here charging $25 for a plate of fucking pasta and sauce. It's ridiculous. But I do it more as a pantry staple for guests. You know, I'm like, hey, we make the pasta, you buy the pasta, you can hold on to it. And, you know, we'll have the occasional pasta dish that comes out of here too. And that's cool, you know, but it's just different. It's and that adaptation towards it, I've always been open to it because I don't have investors and I don't have people to help me out with any of that. And it's purely on me. So if I don't move fast enough or if I don't figure things out, then I'm dead in the water. And there's a lot of stuff that I want to do still. And there's employees that I have and there's other, you know, financial obligations with like rent and all these other things. Like we didn't get a break on rent. I'm still paying for an entire space that I can't really use 60% of it. And we're still paying full tilt rent on it. So it's one thing after another. But that's how this industry is, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a huge part of it where, you know, the issues that have been faced, obviously everybody's facing issues during this time period, but mm-hmm. I think about those places that are communal gathering places. And as a restaurant, you're not going to be able to be open in the same way that you were pre-pandemic, obviously capacity. Yeah. Sometimes there are periods mm-hmm. where you couldn't be open at all, and to still have to be paying rent for those spaces. Yeah. I mean, I have, my company has an office which is now open. There was a period of time that it wasn't, and we're paying the exact same amount of rent. And to me, that is such a failure at the government level of not yeah. supporting these businesses. And it puts people into tough positions because you're out there knowing that you're having to pay this rent to pay these employees to keep things going, and really just finding ways to get in as much income as you can under these difficult circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, and that's been the thing. I knew that right at the gate of the pandemic starting that we were going to be abandoned. And I was like, Dad just went out for cigarettes and is not coming back. So we're going to have to fucking figure this shit out for ourselves. But that was the last administration. It was obvious. You know, it was obvious that was going to be the case. And so, you know, I had to draw the hard line, and I had to sit here and put myself out there more so than I wanted to, with what I was going to do and how I was going to do it, because I had to drive that home and tell my guests, we're not going to open. We're not going to do this indoor dining, like spin the wheel of occupancy. Like, we're not doing that. I'm not going to wait. Because we don't have the same interests, you know, local government, state and federal, they don't know anything about what I'm doing other than give us money, give us your tax money. Right. So there isn't anything independently driven towards me. So I'm not going to do the same thing in return. So my thing is, I'll make a hard stance and, you know, deal with the repercussions. I've lost guests, you know, I've lost guests because they wanted something from us, or they, you know, wanted to give me a ton of money to go cook in their homes. And I'm like, are you stupid? This is not, it does defuse a purpose. Like, fuck you. And so it's, there's a lot of weird things that come out of it. So, you know, having to draw the line and then basically be very aggressive about it, with expectations, and then telling people, like, even in 2021, I'm like, we're not going to do in-room dining at all. Like, 0%. Like, we're not doing it. It's not okay. It's not smart. And you look at, like, vaccine rollout schedules and any sort of hospitality stuff, we're not even scheduled to get them yet. And they were like, we'll talk about it in May. And I'm like, well, that could really give you only from May till about September, about two and a half months of doing something like an in-room dining. And then October slows down, November comes back for holidays. So you basically have 4 weeks from that point to really do anything. And that's if they hand them out to, you know, industry people. But that's people that are further in line than the normal at-home person. So if you're going to roll the dice, you could essentially have one person that has COVID in your restaurant, and then they contact trace it back to you, you get shut down because you have to deep clean and do all this stuff. And that could be later on down the line. That could be in November, right? As you're about to put out your holiday menus, and they can just say, you got to deep clean, you got to close. You know, so it's like, I'm not doing that. No, thank you. And I was like, if anybody's going to take this place out, it's going to be me, not you. Thank you.
So you're closed for all of 2021, no matter what.
Yeah. 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 And this will be our last year in this space. So it was only a 3-year lease to begin with. So I have another thing I'm working on, that is completely adapted of essentially like playing a game of Fallout. Like, I'm going to be like the last little cockroach standing. What happens if that's the case, you know? Cause, I've gotten to the point where we've had to go through a bunch of stuff over this last year. And I want to be in a position where I don't necessarily want to take all of that on again. No matter how good or bad the next administration is, cool, but I can't put myself in that spot mentally or physically anymore. So the next iteration of what the company is going to be, it's very much so that, which is cool. So.
Interesting. Well, I think beyond that, also curious kind of your thoughts, you know, as we've gone through this year post the murder of George Floyd and the Black Lives mm-hmm. Matter protests that happened after that, kind of what your perspective is from the chef's perspective, and then also as a restaurant in general, of how you can help inflict social change, you know, from that role.
Yeah, I mean, I'm Puerto Rican. Puerto Rican kid that grew up in Seattle. There's zero representation here. You know what I mean? Fortunately for me, I'm a little bit lighter skin. So I don't have to deal with 99% of the problems that Black people do or Indigenous people. I'm pretty androgynous when it comes to like people who don't look at me and go, that guy's Puerto Rican. That's fine. But I think a lot more needs to be done to help Black people to get restaurants, to get funding, to get be put out into a situation where it's not just a Black person being put into a white neighborhood with their restaurant. It needs to be Black people being put in a position and getting the funding needed to serve their own community or to do whatever they need to do to help. Because a lot of times, Seattle is very segregated and a lot of people don't realize that. because they don't look and see their neighbors across the street who are all living in basically $1 million houses. And they have that little fucking post market sign that says like Black Lives Matter and this other one that says Unity and all these things. And they're driving, a Subaru and a $2 million house and they have all this shit. But they don't really understand like what they can do because they don't reach out. Now, if they want to say they want to reach out, then the neighborhood has to be that way. And there aren't very many communities around the city that look like that. When I put my business here in Ballard, I looked at census information and 89% of it was white. And I'm like, how the fuck am I going to like try to do Puerto Rican food here? And that's a big problem. That's a big problem. How are you going to get Black chefs, Black community to come into Ballard? It doesn't work for them. It's not representative of them. It doesn't seem welcoming. There aren't very many areas in Seattle that seem welcoming like that. Tell a Black person to go open a restaurant in Magnolia. Fuck out of here. That's not happening, and it's not okay. And it's because it doesn't seem like they can. And it doesn't seem like there's programs available to them, whether it's banking or mentorships or anything else like that, that's readily accessible and available. It's a cool sounding thing for people to say, oh yeah, Black Lives Matter. But I mean, we all saw how quickly that went down again. And how people quickly went to worrying about, the presidential campaign. And then now the presidential campaign's happened and it's okay. So what's the next step? And why did you forget about Black people? And not even 2 days ago, there's a protest and Seattle Police Department's macing people and hitting them with bikes again. And that happens very quickly all of a sudden, and it's like that the marches and the talking and the conversations never stopped. It just wasn't accepted by enough people to push it forward. And the people that needed to hear it and help push it forward are the people with the money and having to be here in Seattle, that's white people. So a lot more needs to happen there. I'm not definitely not the right person to help that process, but I would be as vocal as I can. I just don't have extra time. I'm here 7 days a week, you know what I mean? I have tons of friends that we go back and forth on everything and the underlying side of when protests were happening and like our restaurant was actually feeding protesters and going out and trying to help other people do things. And, we took days off to have our employees go protest and all these kinds of things. I wasn't doing that to get like a pat on the back or seem like some cool place. It's just what needed to happen. Unfortunately, I am a restaurant. I'm not Amazon. I'm not Microsoft. I'm not anything. So my dollar doesn't go very far, but my voice can. So however I can, help out in any way.
Absolutely. That sounds like a great way to support also when you're talking about, having your employees, giving them time off to go and actually be part of that movement rather than just being like, well, you got to be here at work.
Yeah.
There are things that are more important than work.
It really is, man. And that's the adaptation of a lot of this stuff. And, and I saw other like restaurant owners around here complaining about protests and all this kind of stuff, or they had places in Capitol Hill they had to board up and all these things. And I'm like, that's fine that you're saying that, but you're kind of blind to like what everybody's wanting out of this. And you can either board up your walls or you can be supportive of it. But at the end of the day, you have insurance. The fucked up part is during a pandemic, if somebody was to ransack and burn your place, you can actually get an insurance claim on it and then you'll be fine, but you can't do that with the pandemic. That's not covered in the insurance. So if anything, just be supportive. And these are all people that you know, live in the community. So why aren't you being supportive of your community? And you know, at that point, you know, if you aren't a supporter of your community, then who are you? Is it because you have a bunch of investors that just need to blow money on a pet project so they can have somewhere to go eat? Are you from California or some other place that you just moved here because you thought it was going to be easy? I don't know. But you know, I'm from here. I don't intend on going anywhere. So last thing I want is people to go like, hey, that's that place down there. And, you know, they hate Black lives. That's crazy. So it's like, you know, and it's not just automatically discovering it one day. It's seeing it the entire time. And when people go, oh my God, this has all changed. And oh, this is, you know, like a couple, you see people over the last 2 days or day or so going like, wow, breath of fresh air. And I'm like, must be nice. For who? For who, man? Like, who are you? That's cool that you got your president, but we're not even scraping the surface on how to fix all of this stuff or make it better for people that aren't you. And I think that's the priority, because there's a lot of people that need help. When I look at how disproportionate it is that Black and Latino people have died from the pandemic. And then we've prioritized vaccines to people in a very different way, but then also called us essential. So then I'm like, so what are we essential for? Getting you food? and if it's just that, then don't call us essential. Just call us, a butler or the help, but don't lump us in as essential. That's not okay. Because if you're not willing to come back with a couple shots in our arms, then we're not essential.
Yeah, there's just a disconnect in terms of the expressed priorities and then the actions you see kind of behind them.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to yell at me because I'm going to charge $17, $16 for ramen. And I'm going to yell at you that, why do you have a vaccine before me?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's great insight to hear from your perspective, and it's something that honestly, like, we hadn't considered. And you know, having that conversation, whether there are folks lobbying to get restaurant workers to get vaccines sooner,
I think
it totally makes sense, where you're the ones who are actually going there. You know, I'm able to do my job from a basement, right? But you actually have to go to a location with other folks and be making those dishes. You have other people coming into the restaurant to pick stuff up. It's not quite the same as having, and there are other locations that are serving food, you know, that have diners in the building.
You know, and travel's still open. You still have people like flight attendants, and you have hospitality people all the way up and down. You have, you know, janitors and cleaners at hotels and hospitals. And you have all these people that are in Tyson plants just dying left and right because they need to get meat so people can freak out about a Popeye's chicken sandwich, you know? And so there's a lot of that stuff. It's very cause and effect. And it's goes like, how do we build the hype? And, you know, seeing a Twitter handle for like Wendy's being super cute about stuff, but then realizing the darkness behind that, how they're getting the product to sell at $3 or $4 that people can be like, wow, this is great. Good job, Wendy's. And they look at the little redhead cartoon and they think that's what it is. And I'm like, that's not what it is, man. The process to get that all the way through, it's a bunch of people that are being taken care of or being, you know, treated like they're essential.
I want to come back to something you mentioned about, you know, feeling the part of a community, being part of a community is a restaurant. Are there restaurants that you particularly like that, you know, stand out to you as being part of the community?
Yeah, there's a few. There's a few. The problem with restaurant structure is we're not set up as nonprofits. So that makes it really hard to hinge one side of your business to help as much as you can and the other one that you can't. There's been a few during the pandemic that have changed to do something more like that, but the overall business structure won't help it sustain itself. We did a lot of that at the beginning of the pandemic from March through about July. And we were like feeding hospitals and feeding people. I mean, man, we were doing like almost 1,000 to like 1,200 meals a week that were just on donation. People were giving us money. We were turning it around dollar for dollar, and it was going right out the door with helping us, you know, keep our staffing and all that stuff and hourly. That's great, but without secondary money coming in, which never came from, it then relied on who had friends that could give them more money, or organizations that were built, so like World Central Kitchen, that kind of thing. Yep. But it still wasn't enough, and it's still not enough, and it's still never going to be enough. And that's a major miss on the way that this country is set up, because it's not built to help everyone. It's built to help a few. It's not like doesn't feel customized. It just feels like a blanket policy for a few that have influence. And so the hardest thing to see is when you see people food, in lines to get food. They show people in like Houston or El Paso and here in, Washington and all over places. And it's like, man, like you have the stock market way up here. And then you have these people way down here. And then there's a lot more people in the middle that are just kind of like wondering what's going on. And on a community level, it feels that way still. I feel like I have the guilt of I could be doing a lot more. And I would love to, but it's money. It really is. It really is money and logistics and all that stuff's easy, but it makes it easier with like having money to do stuff. So.
Absolutely. What about as far as eating at other restaurants? How much are you doing? How much do you do of that ever? And then how much are you doing of that right now?
I used to eat everywhere all the time. when I could, Ingrid and myself, we would actually travel and go eat at places and, just to get an idea of what's going on and see how much my food sucked. and that was part of it. And when I worked in a restaurant, Chicago was like one of the best ones in the world. And that was like actually my job. Like that was my job to do that. I would travel around with chef and we would go around the world eating at the best restaurant in the world with the best chefs.
That sounds part like of, the best job ever.
It was. There's no bullshit, man. it was rad. I spent 3.5 years doing that. I worked for the Alinea Group, and I was like the right hand guy to Chef Ackett. So when he traveled, I traveled. When we did something around the world, if we were setting up dinners or whatever, like it was like SEAL Team 6 kind of shit where like I was coming in and building stuff and making things happen. And all of the most famous people chef wise in this industry, like I've met them and it's cool, but that goes with the process of knowing what that was. But now we haven't really, I've eaten at two places, not at, but like ordered from three places. Taichi's place, Sushi Cup of Tamura, like that. To me, that's like gold standard, but we don't do that very often because it's kind of expensive for us. Bakabak, because Brian, I love Brian, and his chicken's dope. I love it. And then from there, Sizzling Pot King. I love Szechuan food, so anytime I can get a chance to get some sort of Szechuan food in my life is dope. But I wish I could order more. But me, I'm just here. I mean, I get here sometimes, 8 or 9 in the morning, and I'm here till like 1 or 2 in the morning. And that's still doing stuff, whether it's my laptop or phone. So it sucks, but it's just the reality. So I have to kind of, it sucks because I actually cook for myself a lot more now.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I have to force myself to eat this shitty food. Damn it.
I feel like that's still way better than like us cooking for ourselves more over the past year.
I don't know. I get the times where I'm just like, I like to eat like Hot Pockets and stupid shit like that because I just don't want to think about it sometimes, or like frozen spring rolls or something, just like something dumb. I eat a lot of ramen, like the not fancy stuff. There's the two, there's the old school style that's like 75 cents. And then there's this really slight.
If you're paying 75 cents, I feel like you're overpaying for it.
I buy it in the box. I haven't broken down the pricing, but I get the other one. It comes in the 6-pack at Iwajimaya, and it's like the super spicy one. That one's, that's my go-to. I eat like shit. I wish it could be like sounds fancy, but I don't like to take care of myself that way. I'd rather do it for other people.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Well, you know, the thing that we do on the Pelton Cast is we do search for Seattle's best. So excited to hear about the restaurants that you're talking about, because one of them we actually talked about yesterday, which was Bacabac. But want to get your perspective.
What did you think about it?
Oh, love Bacabac.
Yeah.
No, there's no question about that. And right now, so we're going to hit you with a few of them. For your Seattle's best of a few different categories of food. And we might as well start with fried chicken, because that's what we're searching for right now.
Yeah. That's tough, man. One of my favorites when I used to be able to go to was Maono. It's solid. The thing that, so Mark and Marjorie, they're fucking amazing. And they've been doing it for a really long time, and they just get it on all sides, whether it's their dining rooms or the ambiance, but the food, man, they kill it. The one thing that I like about them is that they actually have a really obscenely spicy sauce, which I like a lot, because I like really spicy food. And that on their fried chicken sandwich that they do, it's dope. Evened up with fried chicken, I would say Bacabac. But those are like my go-tos. I've never gone around going like, I want to find the best fried chicken, but Maono, I would say, is probably, to me, Maono is the best, bar none. When they used to be, they were like almost like a fine dining restaurant in West Seattle. This is probably like 10 years ago. And then they switched over to being just Maono fried chicken. It's dope. It's dope.
That was the winner of our best sandwich in Seattle.
Oh, okay.
It was the Maono fried chicken sandwich.
Yeah, it's so good. Cam, who's their chef for a while there, like he, you know, kind of helped put that thing together, and it's good, man. They have a good thing going.
We also had Cam on our other side podcast. Yeah. Is about Taco Time specifically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he demanded to come on that one since he loves Taco Time so much.
He's great, man. I really have a lot of respect from him, man. He's a really good cook, and he's an even better person. You know, just seeing how he interacts with his kids and how he interacts with people in the industry, like he's a really good guy.
All right, next up, burger.
Oh man. At what level? Like every day, kind of whatever.
See, that's I feel like that's left for you.
Okay.
You can go different categories.
Loretta's.
We're in lockstep agreement at this point.
Yeah, two for two. Loretta's, and not even, I don't even think there's number two, to be honest.
Tristan isn't allowed to comment that though, because he did not vote for Loretta's as Seattle's best.
What did you vote for?
I did.
Tristan, what did you vote for?
I feel like it was we had a miscommunication. No. No, I did. It's been Seattle's best burger for a decade. I voted for You Need a Burger.
Okay. Yeah. I have a burger. I'm pretty proud of it. I'll have you guys try that one. Well, I'll put it on the menu soon. It's called a Richard. It's a play off of Dick's Burger, just a little bit more refined because it's Richard. it's pretty good. But Loretta's, man, that's like the one burger in Seattle where I want bad. There's another one in Portland. I forgot the name of the place. Burger Stevens.
Yes, very good.
That is that's the best one in the Northwest.
Interesting.
Bar none. Not even close.
Interesting. I don't think I like it better than Loretta's, but it's quite good.
I also like the Loretta's like vibe going there, and I'm like, yeah, this is like Seattle for real. You know, like drink a couple Olympias, have a Loretta's burger, hang out, see people come in, do the thing. And I'm like, okay, we're in Seattle. That's also part of that little ambiance I like.
It's the best vibe in all of Seattle.
Yeah.
Loretta's.
Yeah.
Like Loretta's on like 6 p.m. on like a Thursday or something on a sunny in the summer. Man, there's no place better on earth.
I'm a small person. I've always had there's a weird part of my head where like this would be a good place for like a bar fight. but I'm tiny, so that would never happen. So it just happens in my head. I'm like, man, this is like one of these places that would be like the perfect place for like a bar fight, like Old K Corral style bar fight. But yeah, just
okay. We got to talk about Olympia now, because we posted last week on Twitter about the cheap beer taste test we did many years ago, that Olympia emerged as the blind taste test winner. And then we just continue to drink Rainier because that's kind of, you know, our beer. But I feel like you growing up in Olympia must have that same connection to Olympia.
I do, man. I come from a different culture than most people. Meaning, when I was growing up, my parents would, or grandparents would be like, try this. And it was rum. It was whatever they were drinking. They're like, if you want to try it, try it. Just don't be stupid about it. So I knew what Olympia beer tasted like when I was a little kid. And I've known what it has tasted like forever. So when I started moving around, and my dad was military, so we started moving around and we kind of went to different places, you know, Shinerbach and all these other different kinds of things, and Abita beer and all you name it. I always went back and I said, man, that fucking Olympia beer. And it went away for a while. So that was kind of like the thing where I talked to people. I was like, no, this is beer. You don't understand. It's not fancy. It's like a dollar. It's shit. But it still tastes better than a Miller Lite or a Budweiser or a Bud Light or, you know, all these other things. And our school field trips every year were to Olympia Brewery. You know, the Tumwater Brewery. It's the Tumwater Brewery that, you know, did Olympia beer. So the sights, the sounds, the smells, like you would smell like it. You would smell, I would go home and I'm like, I smell like a brewery. Like it was cool. That was fucking great. So when it disappeared, it was like, it was sad. And then it came back, but obviously not in the same space. And then there's still people going like, well, it's not the water. And they're whining, complaining about how it's not whatever. And I'm like, I don't care. It's still Olympia beer and I'll take it. So for me, Olympia beer is very similar to a beer in Puerto Rico called Medalla, which you can't actually get here. You can get it in Miami because they just started distributing over the last couple of years. You can get it in Maryland. There's one restaurant that gets a big order and they actually ship it. And they're down in Lakewood. They're called Old San Juan. They do super great Puerto Rican food. But it's really hard to find unless you're on the island. It tastes almost exactly like Olympia beer. I've had like Puerto Rican people I brought in, like, no, this is on Medalla, trust me, try this. And they're like, holy shit. I'm like, I know, right? So it's actually kind of cool.
Wow. I also love the visual of a bunch of kids going home smelling like Oli. It's, I mean, yeah, a beautiful thing.
No, it was literally that. Like, we did two field trips a year, and one was to like the Lewis and Clark Trail or the brewery. That was like the options. And, you know, okay, cool, like I never did Lewis and Clark Trail, awesome, this is great. And then we go to the brewery and I'm like, hey, we're back at the brewery, and you can't try anything, can't taste anything, you know. It's the most anticlimactic thing because you're going through it and you're like, oh, that was beer, cool. And you don't, they give you like a soda. Here's some Coca-Cola. Wow, thank you.
Okay, a couple more of Seattle's best for you. Mm-hmm. Seattle's best taco or burrito?
No.
Wow.
<Mm-mm>. Sorry.
Redacted. No answer.
No, not here, man. It's this is not it. Fly to LA.
Okay, what about in LA?
So many. Oh my god, there's like, you can go anywhere. It's just a different culture. It's a different culture. And I think it's a long-standing culture. It helps that, and generations of people working on the recipes and doing the thing. You can go anywhere. You can go to Mission District in San Francisco. It's a million times better than anything you'll get up here. And that's not to talk shit about anything that, you know, I like Tacos Chuquis. I think tacos is great. But it's not something that I'm going to go out of my way to eat or tell somebody that it's like the best thing in Seattle. It's just, we don't do Latin American food good in Seattle at all. And that's me ranting for the many years I've been ranting about it. I wish there was a good burrito.
How about ramen?
Oink is yeah.
This is uncanny. Oink is
my gold standard. Perfect 5 for 5 or whatever.
Yeah, oink is the one where I'm like, I live right down the street from it. So you know, even when they opened, I was like, it's cool. Like, you know, I kind of saw their evolution from them doing it to them making their own noodles and having the machine in there and talking to the chef, talking to owners. They're super sweet. They're so nice. And understanding the vibe of like when they close and then they, you know, go home and they source ingredients, or they just take some time to chill. I love everything about that space and the food that they're doing there. And they still have creativity within the ramen that they're doing as well. It's not just purely here's Japanese. It's like, no, we're going to throw these Szechuan chili in here. We're going to make it a little tingly. And I like that. I like how it's not just going to try to be this traditional thing. But I would, Oink is, that's the one where I'm like, yeah, this is the one. This is the way.
All right. Well, you've confirmed for us that we're right on everything. Pretty wild. I was expecting some very different choices. So feeling very good about ourselves right now in our previous searches.
For ramen, it's tough too, because I was in Japan for a little bit, work stuff when I was in that job. And we went around, and at every level of a place where I had ramen at, whether it was a vending machine or a sit down restaurant or anything else, is just completely different class for it. It's not the same thing. It's not the same thing. We were in Hakodate and went to a place that was a 12th generation ramen place. And they make two different types of ramen. And the one that they make is very particular. That's the one that they're known for. And that it was really its own thing. So when people talk about like what ramen is, I'm like, it's a very different conversation. And I try not to, muddy the waters with that. Because it makes it seem like, here's this guy talking shit and he's telling us like we know more. And it's not that at all. It's experiencing it. It's a very different thing. That's why I like the Oink approach, because it's not traditional. Because when I think when people try to go too towards traditional, they miss. And that's unfortunate, because the ingredients are very different. Access to ingredients is very different here. I say that as a guy cooking Puerto Rican food here, because I do that and I am Puerto Rican. We don't have the access to the same ingredients. There's stuff that's native to the island that doesn't come up here. Avocados are different. The yuca is different. Everything is there. The cilantro is different. Culantro is different. Everything. So having to map that and then sell it as such and tell people, hey, here's what we do and here's why, then that makes it make more sense. And then something like an Oink can focus on making a dope ass bowl of ramen, which they do, and it works, and I like it.
Which is spicier, Oink's spiciest ramen or the spicy pollo that you put on the menu at 206?
I would say they're equal. I have this really sick ability for spicy food. I don't know why. So even that one for me is like a 5 out of 10. I have levels of where I want to take it. I want to basically give another one that's like an extreme kind of knock you on your living room floor one. Because we do like a hot sauce challenge every couple, every once in a while. It's very similar to the hot wings challenge. And I give people like 6 wings and I watch them on a Zoom call, basically just killing themselves in their apartment, which is amazing. And we have one that's coming up in a couple weeks. And I said, hey, last time I got you guys on this, 1 million Scoville unit wing, everybody was like passing out, running out the door. Like there's people like pouring milk on themselves. It was great. But I said, I'm going to crush you guys this time. I have an extract that's 4 million Scoville units. You're all dead now. And so that's fun for me. And so I kind of want to do that with the ramen. I want to have like a series or a week that we do like obscenely spicy ramen challenge. And then basically get in a format like this where I get to watch people eat obscenely spicy ramen. Cause that's fun for me.
You're a masochist.
Yeah. Great. It's great.
That's Tristan's so going funny. To sign up for that. I'm going to stick to the Shoncito.
Yeah, it's been well received. I mean, I'll put it that way. It was you guys saying, hey, do you make a spicy one? And I was like, oh my God, yeah, it's easy. And so that's kind of where the idea from it is off of you guys. So, and I was working on one anyway. I'm always having a hard time. I filter myself too much. So I said, hey, what if I do it? And I put it on that day and then it started selling. And I'm like, oh shit, that's where a spicy ramen place now. So it was fun. And then now that it's starting to be over the last week or so, a little bit more known, I'm starting to get the people that are like, yeah, it could be more spicy. And I'm like, oh, talk shit, get hit. Here it comes. So I'm like, oh, I got you. You're fine. You want a four million Scoville unit fucking ramen? Okay. Oh, wow. All right. So yeah, whatever that, you know, again, it goes back to the thing of if you guys want it, I'll try. I'll try to make it.
Well, that's awesome. Love that attitude that you've had the entire, you know, through this whole pandemic and keeping everybody fed, supporting the community has been awesome. Thank you so much for doing that. One last question for you before mm-hmm. you go. Is there anybody else in the Seattle chef community that you think we should have on this podcast?
I'm thinking of like who hasn't had to close a restaurant where it would be super depressing. Cause that's tough, man. Trying to think of somebody, you know, Tai Chi would be great. Tai Chi would be awesome. He's dope. Or Mark and Marjorie. They'd be, I mean, they're like OG, man. They know, they've seen this industry forever. I think they'd be great, especially since you guys like their fried chicken sandwich already. I mean, it's not an awkward conversation at all. But, you know, even the chef at Oink, I mean, that'd be cool too. Maybe get their perspective on what they think is good ramen or not, because we're probably all wrong, you know, which is cool too. you know who else too? Brian from Bakabak. He's a character, man. He'd be great. And he's one of the first chefs I worked for in the city. So he's great, man. Him and his wife and kids and everything. He's a good dude. So, yeah, I think there's four people there.
There you go.
Yeah. You've given us a good list.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and talking about food here today. Getting some of your perspectives on Seattle's Best. This was awesome.
No, thanks for having me. I really appreciate you guys. Keep doing your thing. Stay safe and all that good stuff. If you guys get hungry, let me know. I got you.
We'll be there. I saw the Puerto Rican bolognese. It was just like, yeah,
it's good, man. You know what? That's actually one where I'm like, that this is good. Cause it is good. It's a standard bolognese, but I finished it in the style of Puerto Rican picadillo. So it's got the beef in there mixed with a little bit of tartness. And then it's like leveled down with dairy, and it's really good, and it's super simple. I like it.
We mentioned social media. Where can people follow you?
Eric Rivera Cooks. I'm pretty simple with that one. On Instagram, Facebook, or Otto Seattle, ADDO Seattle, that one too. If you follow me on Twitter, I'm sorry. But if you just like, pictures, if you just like pictures and me not like fucking going off on people, on Twitter, don't follow me there. Just do the Instagram pretty pictures. I take them all myself. So, and I have a, you know, we have a puppy, so the puppy's adorable. But yeah, just if you don't want to get riled up, don't go on Twitter. just ignore it completely.
Just probably good advice, generally speaking.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm older now, and I've kind of found like that has been over the last year of being locked into stuff as like my place to like sound off on things, and it actually works for me. So I'm like, it's fine. But here's some pretty pictures on Instagram if you don't want to hear that shit.
All right, thanks again for doing this.
Cool, thanks. Sorry, guys, I appreciate it.
If you're new to the PeltonCast, thanks so much for listening. Our regular weekly pods cover both Seattle sports and food. As we mentioned, we're currently starting our search for Seattle's best fried chicken. We're planning to bring you the Seattle Chef series a couple of times a month as we try to highlight and support some of the best of the Seattle restaurant scene during this difficult time for the industry. They'll be part of the regular PeltonCast feed, so stay tuned for more interviews.